Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Hate and politics.
Never has hate been such a focus in a political campaign.
That was renowned civil rights advocate Morris Deas as he appeared on this program earlier this week. This concern has inspired the organization Hate Breakers to wonder what will happen to that hate when the election is over. Hate Breakers is a St. Louis not-for-profit organization with a mission to interrupt the pattern and path of hate. It's sponsoring a panel discussion titled, How Can We Hit the Brakes on Hate After Election Day? That's tomorrow at the museum. Joining me to talk about the issue of hate in politics is Susan Balk, journalist and founder of Hate Breakers. Susan, nice to have you with us.
Pleasure.
You know, I'd like to draw the distinction between hate and animosity and dislike. There seem to be many gradations of hate, if you will. How do you define it?
Hate is a very primitive emotion. It's like love, and I think we both have it in us. We all have both in us. I like to think of it as two dogs that are fighting, and you wonder, is one of them going to win? And what I believe is the dog that wins is the dog we feed. And we try to help people not feed that knee-jerk, very human reaction.
There's a lot of talk about hate, obviously, in this political campaign. But I wonder if it has been tempered somewhat and even diluted by the fact that I can see a child saying, I hate school, or I can say, I hate Brussels sprouts. That's quite different.
It's different. It's that same negative emotion we have. Hate Breakers focuses on hitting the brakes on acts of hate. A lot of that emotion is unconscious. And so part of our work is spotlighting people from all walks of life, three different genocides, who have experienced hate either as victims or targets or as perpetrators or as witnesses who did or didn't do anything.
What are you seeing in today's political world that justifies the use of the word hate?
I find that there are friends who know what I do and who say, you know, I don't even get together with my brother or my friends or my people from church because I can't talk to them, because the velocity of our conversations is beyond control. And what I usually say is, are you going directly to hate, or are you listening to what they're saying? Because I think if you're for Hillary, be for Hillary. If you're for the Donald, be for Trump. But why turn that into hatred for the other side? We all want to help issues that we're concerned about in this country.
There are friendships, certainly, that have been broken or disrupted by the current political climate. Are these friendships repairable?
Well, we're going to find out tomorrow night, because I got a call actually from an adult brother and sister, one extremely pro-Trump, one extremely and passionately pro-Hillary Clinton, and they love each other, but they find that they can't talk to each other right now. And if something about politics slips in, it's a trigger, and they go off. So they said they were going to be there, and they're hoping that members of the panel will be able to help them through this. It's a tough conversation.
Tough indeed, and that's going to be happening at 7 o'clock at the History Museum's Lee Auditorium
tomorrow night.
We have information on that on our website. You know, I have to tell you about an experiment that I tried this week on Facebook. I put out a question or two with regard to the election and, you know, the concern what could happen on election day in terms of intimidation of voters potentially, or what could happen November 9th if it's a close election. And I had hundreds of responses to it. And the first wave of responses was, you know, people just kind of reacting to it. And then there were people reacting to the reactions. And I never saw a conversation devolve as quickly as this, because suddenly it became hateful. The language that was being used are words that you wouldn't hear in the, you know, in the roughest schoolyard or in the U.S. Navy, if you will. And I was amazed at how quickly it just degenerated to this point. That's what we're talking about.
Yes, it is. It's wishing harm to somebody who we have a hard time forgiving or we have a hard time listening to. And that's why we work both in the schools and in the community and even internationally to try to foster these tough conversations.
I'd like to play a clip now again from Morris Dees, whom we heard from at the top of the program, the continuation of his comment as to what he believes hate is in this campaign, and he definitely believes hate is a part of it.
Never has hate been such a focus in a political campaign, whether it's blacks or Latinos or people who are coming from different Arab countries, by a man who essentially is appealing to middle-class whites, most of them not educated.
So you heard what he had to say. You agree with what he's talking about?
I'm not a deep enough student of history to know about the never part. I think it's been a pattern internationally. We work as hard as we can so that we don't repeat some of the things that have happened. And one of the reasons I've been a member and a fan of Morris Dees and his organization is because they keep track of acts of hate. They document these things. And believe me, if I didn't think we were doing something different, I'd just keep on writing my check, you know, doing what I could to support what they do, which is important. What we do is look at acts of hate, is observe acts of hate, and find people who have either as perpetrators or as witnesses who weren't able to do something at the time or as victims, instead of being limited or defined by that wallop of hate, use it as a way of trying to fix the world. So we gather, I'm a journalist, and I've interviewed dozens and dozens of people who have specifically shown that ability, that moral courage to say, this happened to me, and I don't want this specific thing to happen to other people.
This has been going on. Your organization, if I remember correctly, 2009, is that when it was formed?
Yes.
Yeah. What kind of success have you had in through these interviews and through these discussions with people changing attitudes?
Well, it's being measured right now. We have a program in the schools called Meet a Hero, Be a Hero, which takes appropriate, for the particular demographic or classroom, takes some of these interviews and works around them. We suggest interactive activities for the teacher and for the facilitator. And we see how effective this cumulative program of role models is. And what do the students get from these tough conversations? And so we document each time it's shown, either in a rural community, which it has been, in North County, in West County, and more recently in a very, very tough neighborhood in Chicago. Several people tried this, and we're told that the students do walk away with a sense of what's possible instead of being locked into this definition of hate for themselves.
Is it easier, have you find, or are you finding easier in urban areas as opposed to rural areas, for instance, or is there a distinction between them?
There are distinctions between them, but this is a tough conversation we're looking to have. And the reason we're working so hard to do this is we really believe in the research that shows that role models make a difference. And you show that in your program every day. I'm changed a little bit each time I hear somebody talk about what he or she is doing. And we're finding that the students in the schools, that when we have our annual Hate Breaker Hero Awards each May, people walk out. The last year, I heard somebody behind me saying, you know, I feel good about living in St. Louis now, because we had located some people within our city who, from their experience, knew how to activate their anti-hate mechanisms. And I can tell you about a couple.
Please do.
One man had been the librarian, Scott Bonner, his name is. He'd been the librarian in Ferguson Public Library, I think, for a month. He grew up, he's white. He grew up in rural Missouri, badly bullied and abused. He knew that first day when the town was terrified, I didn't say terrorized, terrified, that closing the schools and closing the stores and closing down was not going to help. And so he made that library a place, a safe place for some teachers to come with their students, for all kinds of forums. And we call somebody like that a hate breaker hero.
The library in Ferguson played a tremendous role. Yes. I know that. We have to take a break now. I'm talking with Susan Balk, who is the founder of Hate Breakers, the organization we're talking about, and its attempt to break this cycle of hate that we have been seeing, particularly in this year's political campaign. We'll come back and continue this conversation in just a couple of moments. Meantime, this is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, Don Marsh back with you, and my guest in studio is Susan Balk, who is the founder of Hate Breakers, an organization which is designed to put the brakes on hate, just as the name would suggest, and we're particularly noticing how significant an issue this is during this year's political campaign. Susan, you gave me one example just before we took that break. You have others, and I think it's important to give us a couple of those so that people will understand exactly how you operate and where you're coming from.
We give dozens of examples of what we call hate breaker heroism, people who, instead of buckling to the wallop of hate, are able to take it to try to fix the world. I think of it sometimes as post-traumatic growth. So let's see. I told you about
The Ferguson Library.
I told you about the Ferguson Library. Robert Pearl was the head of a Nazi skinhead gang, both in and out of prison. As he says in his interview, I did tearfully, I must say, he says, I did some terrible things to people who didn't have it coming. I had never sat down and just talked with a Jewish person or a black person. And now that I have, I realize that there's no difference. He says, my life might have some good meaning if I can help kids not waste the first 30 years of their life hating the way I did.
But I'm still not clear on exactly what turned this guy, Pearl, around. Was there a specific thing, just getting to know? Was it simply getting to know someone that he had feared or disliked or hated before?
Part of it, I'm sure. We focus on the acts of hitting the brakes on hate. A long time ago, I wrote a book called Fame. And I looked at interviewed a lot of people who were celebrities. And I found that fame felt like power. And fame looked like power. But in fact, as we know, it's not power. And even people, I did a chapter on Hollywood and fame in Hollywood, and I went and talked to one of the, at that time, premier psychiatrists. And he said he had to hypnotize people to get them to drop that mask that they said they didn't want to wear. And so, you know, in my next life, I'll get a doctorate in neuropsychology. So I can tell you that that activity happens somewhere in the amygdala. But I'm not an expert on the turning point. And I found in these interviews that we're not always sure of what I think of as an unconscious moment when we change. Mm-hmm. That's why we emphasize the role models, the specific cumulative examples.
What got you into this this whole project to begin with?
Well, my late husband was a Viennese refugee, much older than I am, I have to say, much older than I was. And he was 16 years old, living in Vienna, Jewish, when Hitler and his army were marching in. He was sitting in a movie theater because he thought he might look inconspicuous there. And he told me that even as the army was marching in and he heard the music that was his death knell, his foot was tapping too because it was his music. And so we talked a lot about how hate could take over a whole continent. But we also talked about the Catholic family, total strangers to these Jews who were, had been his relatives, who hid these people for 3.5 years. Mm-hmm. 2 weeks ago, I was in Vienna putting a plaque on the apartment building where that happened. And I've got to tell you, Don, there were 4 generations of the family that were the heroes and 4 generations of the families that were the hidden. And I feel that each of those people, the 4-year-olds and the 84-year-olds, took home a sense of what a hatebreaker hero is. And we believe that that's how we change the world.
You mentioned 4-year-olds. So what would you think the current climate that we've been talking about, the current climate, what effect it's having on young people?
As we've learned, and as Morris points out, kids are scared, especially if they feel vilified in some way. You know, one biracial child says to his mom, "You'll be okay, but I'm not sure about me." It's very, very frightening. We've identified a pattern that begins with bullying or home abuse and goes all the way to sexual abuse, to gang behavior, other kinds of violence, all the way to genocide, that there are certain patterns. So we want to start with these kids and show them that even if they didn't stand up for the little girl or the little boy who was a target the other day, they can move from that and learn from that how hard it is, and next time maybe be able to do it.
And, of course, we're all more fully exposed to this sort of thing, these kinds of things, than ever before, mm-hmm. thanks to media, Internet, and all the rest of it. What about the role of media?
Well, as a journalist, I have to say I'm very disappointed in my people. When I got into this, it was, you know, it was an honor. Woodward and Bernstein were heroes. A lot of people, I taught journalism at Columbia, everybody felt that there was a great power in being able to tell a story. Don't get me started on how I think we've failed or how the media have failed, but I do think it behooves us to be able to say, I don't know why this person expressing herself or himself about the candidate that they support has to be so destructive about the other person. I think we have to learn how to listen, and we work to help children learn how to listen and take part, even in tough conversations. And if people go to our website, they'll see the specific ways that we do that.
Well, we'll put a link to your website on ours.
Thank you.
But civility comes in second after profit, I think, is one of the reasons that we're seeing the kinds of things that we're seeing. Let's get some of our audience into the conversation, Susan. I'll start with Ann Jeanette calling from the Central West End. Ann Jeanette, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you for taking my question and comment. How does the role of segregation, racial and economic segregation of our communities impact the influence of hate? You know, we have many communities that are greatly economically disadvantaged. And in some communities, it becomes like an echo chamber for stereotypes, prejudice, because there's really no way to socially interact with people who are not like one another. So can you speak to that?
Yes, I'm familiar with what I call the bubble that we live in our different neighborhoods. And one of the things that we do on our website is to include everybody so that we can have a close-up conversation with strangers or people different from us, and they can listen to us too. And I would ask you and other people who might be listening to nominate people who they know of that they want other people to know of who have, you know, hit the brakes on hate. That's exactly a concern that we have, is how separated we are from each other.
Thank you for the call, Ann Jeanette. I have an email here which reads, the event is called How Can We Hit the Brakes on Hate After Election Day? Is there a reason why we're not trying to hit the brakes on hate before Election Day, when constructive dialogue might be most appropriate?
That's why we're having our event tomorrow night. Thank you for noticing that. Yes, I think I mentioned that some people got in touch with us who have a hard time talking to each other, our brother and sister who are normally very close. They're grown. They have children. And they want some help. And so we have on the panel Dr. Moisey Schopper, who's a psychoanalyst and who has worked with adolescents and done social justice work in the community, and who is going to help us understand hate in a close-up way. He said to me the other day that in his work with counseling or mediating for husbands and wives, he said, if it's going to lead to divorce, he said, Susan, it's about money and power. And whoever wins hates the person who loses, and vice versa. And I said, well, what about common interest? What about getting together for kids' birthdays or for weddings? And he said, that's the ticket. We've got to find a common interest.
And other panelists include Tapari Coleman, who was on this program from the Anti-Defamation League. He was on the program a week or two ago. Frank Flutron, a former political person here in the state of Missouri, and was well-known. And I guess he's out of politics these days, is he?
He's doing some consulting, as we say. Okay. He has some ideas about what life would be like if political campaigns were actually about issues that people care deeply about and not about sloganeering and triggering.
And, of course, you're going to be on the panel as well.
I am.
Okay, and that's tomorrow at 7 o'clock at the Missouri History Museum in the Lee Auditorium. Susan Balk, thank you so much for being with us. It's going to be interesting to see how all of this plays out. A lot of discussion about what's going to happen on and after Election Day. Thank you so much for being with us.
Pleasure.
Susan is the founder of Hate Breakers, and as we indicated, there's an event at 7 o'clock tomorrow night at the Lee Auditorium at the Missouri History Museum. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.